This is JVL here with my best friend, Tim Miller, and sitting in for my other best friend, my colleague, Sam Stein.
I've been reduced.
That guy. I'm kidding, because we
Sam,
love
yes.
Our other colleague, Jonathan Cohn, will be joining us from Michigan, somewhere on the hand. I don't know which part of the hand he's in later on in the show. We have a lot going on tonight. We're going to be ping-ponging between election results and news of the day and Schadenfreude and some of the worst people in the world. And also, there will be ads. I'm sorry if you're a Bulwark Plus subscriber or a YouTube Premium member. Normally, we don't have ads for you. We cut them out, except for when we do these things live. There's no way to cut them because it's live.
But you still get the comment privileges. You still get the Tim emoji.
Those things? Yeah. Oh, those Tim emoji.
It's worth it.
They're great. So we're going to start first with the big news today. Get all the primary stuff. The conscience of our nation was shocked. When the CEO of MyPillow, Mike Lindell, announced earlier today that he was stepping down in order to focus on his campaign for governor of Minnesota. I don't know how the pillows, whose pillows are they now if they're not his pillows?
Our pillows.
Are they some dude's pillows? Your pillows? Their pillows? What are we supposed to do?
What are we supposed to call him if he's not pillow man? The former pillow man, the erstwhile pillow man. Is not Michelle Tafoya, the former sideline reporter, also in that race?
No, she's running for the Senate.
Okay, it's hard for me to keep track of what's happening over there. I don't think that the prospects are going to be that great for either the erstwhile pillow man or Ms. Tafoya. But who knows? There was that big breaking news in Minnesota last week that the president himself announced, which is that Tim Walz and the state of Minnesota did a cyber attack on our own water supply. And so I guess we have to wait and see what kind of evidence that the president provides for that claim. It's a pretty shocking claim. It's pretty strange, actually, that hasn't led the nightly news and led the New York Times for the past few days, because it's a pretty astonishing claim for the president of the United States. I think any past president who said that a governor was the point person for a cyber attack on our water supply, I think that'd be
on his own water supply.
I think that'd be a pretty big news story, but people are letting that go for now.
Now,
but
many people are saying that Governor Walz also launched an attack on alternative downfill, and that he has tried to take over the global supplies of alternative downfill in order to, I mean, who can say, hurt his political opponents?
Yeah, you can't trust the polls with Mike Lindell. As he said, he was the point man for the insurrection. But you do look at that, and he's down by 20 to Amy Klobuchar in the general election recent Mason Dixon poll.
That's it.
Down by 22 in the Emerson College
one. Well, I mean, you can't believe that. Well,
that was taken before he was splitting his time between the pillows.
They didn't know. They didn't know that he was locked and loaded, ready to go. Yeah. Okay, let's go to real news. Tonight is primary night, and the big one is Michigan Senate, where the blood feud between Haley Stevens and Abdul El-Sayed is finally mercifully coming to a close. Polls are closed now, I believe. We have Jonathan Cohn at the El-Sayed event. He will come and talk to us when he can. Our producers will just ping us and let us know. Right now, we've got only about 17% of the vote in, but El-Sayed is leading by 9. 53-44. He's up by about 20,000 votes so far. Gents, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, Haley Stevens, it's early, but like right now is only up by 3% in Detroit. That's not going to be enough for her. So, I think we'll give kind of full analysis at the end and, speculation here. We'll have a pretty short shelf life, but I think all signs are pointing to an El-Sayed win tonight and probably a pretty early one.
Yeah, it feels that way. We'll wait and see the results. I know Cohn's actually in a spot now where he can come on. But I will just say, ultimately, we'll have time to diagnose this, but ultimately for me, it's going to be a story of APEC backfiring spectacularly. They spent tens of millions of dollars for her, and it probably hurt her, honestly, because got her.
Probably.
Yeah. Definitely. Yeah,
definitely.
Yeah.
What are you seeing in the early results? Because you know this stuff well. Is Stevens underperforming? Is El-Sayed overperforming?
He's overperforming. We're seeing districts where Hillary Clinton beat Bernie Sanders, where Gretchen Whitmer beat El Said back, you know, when they were in the 2000, and he's winning those districts. Now, a lot of this is early vote. Typically early vote, you would think older voters, you would think that would be more Haley Stevens voters. But, you know, we are looking at a record turnout in this. I mean, the numbers, they're talking well over a million, 40, 50% higher than the normal primary. So, you know, I got to think, I mean, again, this is speculative, but I got to think a lot of that early vote is his vote. I mean, his vote is just really committed. And, you know, I look, I've said all along, the eyeball test, if you've been attending the rallies, I mean, he pulls people. She does it. You know, she would do a rally. She'd get, you know, she'd get into an event. She'd get 20, 40, 50 people. A union would bring in some people, or she, you know, she'd go to a church on Sunday. And there's, you know, there's some affection for her, but he was bringing out the people. I've been burned enough. Seeing enthusiasm that doesn't, you know, I remember Howard Dean back in, you know, 2000, whatever.
Nobody showed up to the, nobody showed up to Joe Biden events in 2020.
Right,
I got to tell
right,
you.
Right. And well, right. And so, but I think what we were seeing on the ground, you know, was indicative. And the polls, you know, we were like, well, maybe the polls drop. It doesn't look like it. You know, and Tim, was that where you were saying that her numbers in Detroit, she would have to really just run the table.
Yeah,
Detroit,
I mean, the path for her using the Biden model is just a huge run up with Black voters, and then more kind of the moderate, like kind of suburban voters. But I think this ties back to Sam's AIPAC point that I think that there are a lot of suburban, kind of traditionally normie Dem types that were really turned off by this. And there's a clip going around today. I forget. I think it was MS Now, but I forget who to credit for it, where they're interviewing this mom. You know, this woman who's like, I'm a moderate, I liked Hillary, I liked Kamala, but I'd vote for a communist over somebody that wanted to keep giving money to Israel. So I just think that, like, to her path was really running up the score with Black voters, really doing well with kind of the former Republicans that vote in these primaries, the Pete, Mayor Pete type voters, and the Mallory voters. And I think that just didn't happen. I think that a lot of those voters ended up going for El Sayed.
Yeah. I mean, Sam. Look, I mean, go ahead, Sam.
Yeah, I just wanted to know, I mean, look, obviously we're getting ahead of ourselves, but we're operating off the assumption that El Sayed is going to win this thing. And it looks like it's trending that direction, but I, with the caveat that things can change, whatever. You've watched him in person multiple times. And in your articles that I've read and luckily had the chance to edit, one of the things that you talk about repeatedly is that people kind of underestimate the type of political talent he is. Obviously, there's a load of controversial stuff out there that is going to get resurfaced. Who knows what Republicans are sitting on. But can you speak a little bit to just sort of what you witnessed up close about whether he has the capacity to translate to both MAGA-adjacent voters, but mostly people who are non-political, who he really does need to, in the general, get out and vote?
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, first of all, people say he's, this phrase generational speaker gets overused, but it's kind of true in his stamp. You know, I mean, he is an incredible speaker, debater. I mean, the origin story of Abdul, also a lot of people know this, is he gives a graduation speech at the University of Michigan, and the invited commencement speaker is so blown away. He's like, kid, you got to go into politics. And of course, that's Bill Clinton is the entire, you know, the invited, you know, commencement speaker. He's a great speaker. I mean, even his critics would concede that. He's incredibly smart.
All right. Audio's rough. We're going to let you go, John. Come on back later on if you have more to tell us. Very quickly, Tim. So I was sort of interacting with people in our community about this race today, and some people were saying, like, well, you know, El Sayed, he's really risky. And, like, I don't know how risky he is, because this is a Democratic seat in a state with a Democratic governor in a wave Democratic year. In order for him to lose this race, he would have to be worse than a replacement Democrat by probably like 3 points.
Maybe five.
I mean, he'd have to be a lot worse than generic replacement Democrat.
Yeah. I feel that way. I don't think so. I think he's the sense in which he's risky, I think, are two moderate risks that, and I talked about this a little bit on Monday, that I just would have taken into account if I was thinking about it as a voter. Like, number one, you know, the people of Michigan in general elections during the Trump years have elected a lot of women with Haley Stevens profile. So it's just kind of like, there wasn't really any reason to think that she would not win. And they elected Whitmer, Nessel, Slotkin, et cetera, et cetera. And so I think she was safer than him in that regard. It's a little bit of a wild card. I agree with Jonathan. I think he's really talented. I think a lot of the hits that they throw at him backfire. I think that a lot, and this goes to the APAC question, I think a lot of the attacks about him, about his positions, about Israel, like, might have been really potent attacks 4 years ago. I don't think they are now, and I think that he could lose certainly some potentially gettable voters for that, but I think that's offset like pretty significantly in other demos. So I think that, you know, him talking about the cost of living, talking about the Iran war, talking about, you know, these big corporate interests and big, you know, deep state, and not deep state, but big kind of military interests that have pushed us into these stupid wars, and we should be
$32 million from APAC.
Yeah, and so this goes to the APAC thing. I mean, I just can't, like, even if you were aligned with APAC's point of view and their mission, it is like an unbelievable self-own. Like, Sam, I mean, it's almost kind of undermining the stereotypes about your people, like how incompetent they've been in this. I mean, like, this whole program has been just a rake step after rake step. And look at this. I mean, I just pulled up, what are their big wins the last two cycles since they've started this? They've been putting huge, 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 huge dollars into these Democratic primaries for nothing. I mean, they beat Wesley Bell against Cori Bush. They have a rematch tonight, so we'll see how that goes.
And Bell won.
What? Is that
won.
Yeah, Bell's already won. So, okay. So they got one, and then they got Jamal Bowman in that New York seat. But, like, neither of those were real. I mean, those were self, like, that was Cori Bush and Jamal Bowman were both horrific candidates for a wide variety of reasons we don't need to kind of lay out, but, like, they did themselves in. It wasn't like the super PACs that were succeeded in that. Like, anybody could have beaten those two candidates with how horrible their campaigns were managed. So, like, they have no success. They have, I think, caused increased backlash and negative attitudes towards, kind of their pro-Israel worldview within the Democratic coalition. And I said this on Monday, like, I just think it's reasonable. If there was a Qatari American PAC that was putting $30 million in to a primary, I don't think that anybody would feel like it's anti-Muslim or whatever to be like, I don't know if we want a, you know, even if it's American citizens that are like the KQAPAC, like, even if it's American citizens, I don't think anybody would be like, we really want like the biggest donor in a primary to be a Sharia law dictatorship. Like, nobody would be for that. And so I think
the strategic been a massive decision strategic here failure would have been to sit this election out.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, the Netanyahu government has brought America into this war. It's an incredibly unpopular war. It is making America less safe and hurting America's interest in the world. So in this one particular cycle, you could have just said, you know what, we're just going to keep our powder dry. Seems to me.
Sam, tried to convince Haley not to run, because I think Mallory made some missteps, but I do think that she would have potentially been a stronger candidate. But this was, again, when you add to the APAC missteps, they did this in New Jersey. Like, they had Tom Malinowski, who was like a quasi, certainly at least open to arguments, but had been critical of Israel and had been critical of some of our policies as far as funding Israel. So they went and engaged in that primary in a way that sunk him, and there ended up being a squad, like a DSA squad member wins that seat. So it's just like just a total, like, they're the biggest losers of the primary cycle by a wide margin.
Well, let me try to unpack my thoughts on this, and I'm just actually formulating them right now because I didn't expect that this is what we were going to be talking about. One is, I think that's right, and I think the proof is in the pudding, because APAC's kind of hiding their donations now. They're setting up these front groups that they don't have the APAC association, and so the money's not actually going directly from APAC. It's going to these cutouts, so they know that they're toxic, and they're trying to get around that. The other side of this, though, that's really a little trickier to work through is this, which is APAC's founded to ostensibly improve American-Israeli relations, right? Like, that's the idea. It's like, we want to keep America's support for Israel. What APAC's become associated with is American support for the Netanyahu regime, and that's different. And APAC cannot sever itself from Netanyahu, and they really should, frankly, because there are other Jewish American political action groups that have been critical of Netanyahu, but AIPAC's not one of them. And I think AIPAC would do itself a lot of good if it were more open about having disagreements with the current Israeli government, because the Israeli government's not Israel. It's just a government that runs Israel, and Israel is ostensibly a democracy and the government will change. I think that's the big problem, is that they've basically said, no, you cannot countenance, we cannot countenance any criticism of Israel, and we will throw millions upon millions of dollars of people who will not offer a criticism of Israel. And candidates have for a while taken that exchange because the money's good. And now even the good money doesn't get you very far. And I think, you know, ultimately, and I, you know, I'm not the only one who said this, Rahm Emanuel has said this, others have said this, this falls at the feet of Netanyahu. He burned this bridge. And the longer he's there, the more this bridge is going to get burned. And it's just a shame, honestly.
Substantively, people have legit reasons to be upset.
Yeah.
Like, sure. I mean, like, sure. Is there anti-Semitic comments and tropes from people who are anti, you know, AIPAC, et cetera? Of course. But like, people have legitimate reasons to be upset. The popularity of the country has gone down substantially because of their actions. And like, you know, if you're going to be in a Democratic primary, both morally for the correct, you know, ideological reasons and strategically, like having their support is harmful, not helpful.
Why can't AIPAC understand that Bibi Netanyahu has done for Israel what Donald Trump has done for America on the world stage? Like, it's a very simple, straightforward thing. The parallels are almost identical, right? Like, Canada's having a wholesale realignment of its relationship with America because of the actions of the American president. The rest of the world is having a wholesale realignment of its relations with Israel because of the actions of the Israeli prime minister. Like, it's just, you know, it's not like there's something unique and different here. They're the same guy. Hey, last question, then we're going to get out of here.
We are?
Is it possible?
I thought we had a long night ahead of us.
We're going to get out of this topic. Get out of this topic. We have so much else to talk about. Is it possible that Francesca Hong will be a human shield for Abdul Essayed for the rest of this race?
Absolutely.
Because I look at this and I feel like, you know, America can only fixate on one, like, seemingly way out there DSA tanky type. Not saying Francesca Hong is. She does not like holidays very much, though. It just seems like, I don't know, whenever somebody wants to reach for crazy, she's going to be standing right there. And next to her, we'll see, Ed's going to look amazing.
100%. I can't believe how many holidays she doesn't like. Is there someone was pointed out on Twitter, but she doesn't like Valentine's Day, doesn't like Thanksgiving. Like, yeah.
I agree with you 100%, JVL. And by the way, I'll say it again. There's certain elements. How should I put this? I like the cut of Zohran's jib. He makes me laugh. We're on the podcast. He got into a little controversy, but he's a good hang with me. I'll say it's a little bit less for me, as far as a hang is concerned.
More lax, so, bro, right? Because he's a lax and wrestling bro.
Yeah, whatever. Yeah. And I understand why some people, like what Cohen was saying, might look at it and have it rubbed the wrong way a little bit. But like, outside of that, he is super talented. And I got to tell you, I watched him on, I believe it was over the weekend, when he was on an MSNBC weekend show, and they were asking him about these accusations of anti-Semitism. And his answer was so good and so compelling and well-formulated and thoughtful and felt credible. We can put up during the thing, but basically he was kind of doing a much more eloquent, non-podcasty version of what you were just saying about, like, the increase of anti-Semitism is something that he's concerned about. He thinks that, like, the actions of the Bibi Netanyahu government are perpetrating a lot of it. He talked about the value of the Jewish people, used some language to kind of references, this is more your people, Sam, but, you know, some kind of chosen people, land of milk. I don't know. He used some kind of
very
flowery,
cosmopolitan. They're good with money.
He used flowery biblical language about how much he values them, how many supporters he has on his campaign, and how insulting it is to say that he's anti-Semitic when all he's doing is making a critique on policy. And that it was either in the same interview or in a different one that I watched of his, you know, prepping for this, where he's also good on Ukraine. A lot of that other crowd who is in his kind of more lefty foreign policy world is not really that excited about the U.S. spending money on Ukraine, and you can understand that as a coherent, if you're an isolationist, a coherent policy. But he was kind of tying more like Ukraine to Gaza And he was basically like, you know, Russia attacked Ukraine. They're a free country. We should be able to help them. We can't sit aside. So I think he's super skilled. And I think that I think that a lot of folks who really have like a Twitter or like small short clips view of him misunderstand how deft he might be at being able to handle this stuff in the general.
But to your point, JVL, I think there's always a limited capacity for national media attention. And if Francesca Hong is going to win, and it looks like it, we'll know next week, obviously, I think there's going to be just an absolute sprint of fascination and coverage of every utterance she's ever made in her life, and people are going to obsess over it. And El Sayed is going to benefit, obviously, because there's just not that much. There's a limit, let's say, on the internet's ability to handle multiple conversations, and I think he's going to be more combed over, and she's not, and she's just going to be the flavor of the month. So, yes, human shield.
All right, we're going to move on to Max Miller in a moment. Max Miller, who went on The Lead with Jake Tapper today. Boy, that was fun. First, this show is sponsored by Casper. You know, when you've had that long day and you can't wait to get into bed, no matter what happens, you can always go home to your Casper with snow technology to keep you cool no matter what. One of my kids was sent a Casper mattress, and I had to choose which of the four children would get this luxury Casper mattress with all the cooling technology. You guys will never guess who I gave it to. That's right. Favorite. And she loves it.
Mm.
She's like, Dad, this is the greatest sleep I've ever had. This thing is amazing. She could not believe all she's ever had are like normal kid mattresses. And
do the other children not listen to the podcast?
Her I was life. Say.
None of my children listen to any of the podcasts.
Really? Flash is a consumer of political news.
He's a reader more than a podcast, okay. More than a podcast guy. Anyway, huge, huge hit. I cannot tell you how much she loves it. I will probably wind up having to buy these for the other three kids. And you know what? I won't even feel guilty about it because they're great. Casper makes reliable, high-quality mattresses designed to deliver consistent, comfortable sleep night after night. That's why out of 99 mattresses, Consumer Reports named Casper's the one mattress their top-rated all-foam mattress of 2026. That's a big deal. I actually also am a huge subscriber to and consumer of Consumer Reports, and I noted this when they did their mattress ratings this year. I was like, oh, look at that, our boys Casper taking the top spot. You've been talking about getting a new bed. Now is the time with Casper's back-to-school sale. Head to casper.com and save up to 20% on the mattress you deserve. Casper's mattresses are built to be durable and long-lasting, so you're not replacing your mattress every few years. Their products are designed to withstand the test of time, maintaining support and comfort over the long haul. And Casper has their 100-night risk-free trial, so you can give Casper's mattress a try risk-free. Although with 110,000 five-star reviews, I'm sure you're going to love it, like we do. Remember, the day always ends well with Casper. Right now, save up to 20% on mattresses and up to 25% on everything else when you go to Casper.com one last time. That's Casper.com and save up to 20% on the mattress you deserve. Thank you, Casper. Favorite is grateful.
Wait, are you supposed to replace your mattress every few years? Is that a thing?
I think typically it's like every 10 to 12. Is a recommendation. If you talk to the people at Sleepopolis, you know what? Don't go dragging me down the mattress research rabbit hole because I have very strong feelings about all this.
Sure.
Before we get to Matt Smiller, are we going to wait for Abdul to win to do the socialism discourse? Because I did promise the podcast listeners I had a socialism rant I wanted to
let's,
do.
But let's wait for him to win. I did a socialism thing today, Tim.
I know
maybe
you did.
Read it.
I did.
Max Miller. His ex-father-in-law, Senator Bernie Moreno, spoke to TMZ about his situation in the hallway in the Capitol, and Miller was asked about that by Jake Tapper. Let's give a look.
Let's start there with your former father-in-law's story today about your daughter and the little blue bunny doll that she cannot sleep without. If it's true, that sounds like emotionally abusive behavior toward a toddler to refuse to give it to her when she can't sleep without it.
Jake, I would agree that if that were true, that would be incredibly disturbing and that the senator would be right. However, He has taken 2 years to publicly acknowledge for me to resign from my seat. Why is that, Jake? If he truly believed, like, I'm a father to a 2.5-year-old daughter, I believe that you're also a father to children. And I don't know if you're actually a father to a daughter. But what I can tell you is, well, Jake, then what I can tell you is that if my daughter came to me and she said, my ex-husband did X, Y, and Z, and then I waited because I was nervous that a political live stream was going to expose a deeply impersonal, embarrassing matter to the senator for him to take that action. Sadly, this has nothing to do with my daughter, Jake. And that's what this entire thing is about.
Boys, did he say no? That's a very weak rebuttal about it was, the claim.
You know, it would have been terrible if it happened.
Yeah. I don't know. If someone told me that it was alleged that I denied my 2-year-old, it'd be one thing if the child was like 7. Sometimes a 7-year-old needs to have their toy taken away from them. But that I denied my 2-year-old her beloved bunny after I allegedly injured her collarbone and abused the child. And I think I would have been much more forceful, I guess I would say, in denying that had I not done it. I'd have certainly been a little clearer about how I would never take my child's bunny from her. So I don't know. Count me on the side of believing that he took the bunny.
Sam?
Yeah, none of this was particularly convincing. Bold take there, Tim.
Thank you.
there was like a couple places though where he did that sort of song and dance where it's like, if I were guilty, X would have happened. So he's like, you know, if this really happened, I would be arrested. Or if I really like threw scalding hot water on my ex-wife, why would she cook me dinner in 6 days? And, you know, if I really had done all this, why did Bernie Moreno take 2 years to speak out? And it's like, none of that's a denial. Like, just straight up, it's not denying anything. It's just saying, you know, I couldn't be that bad. Otherwise, I'd be behind bars. And it's just sort of a classic retort for someone who is, in fact, guilty of this stuff, right? It's like, oh, no, I couldn't possibly be the person, the demon that you're portraying me as. So I left this whole interview, and I'm not the only one, obviously, more disturbed at his behavior. I thought his whole affect was weird. It's like, I don't know. He talked about like testosterone replacement therapies that he's getting. He looked incredibly broad-shouldered and no jacket. And it's just like, if he was trying to come off looking psychotic, he did a particularly good job in this interview. And I'm not really sure what the strategy is here.
I try to stay away from stuff like this because I get pretty hot about like men who betray their families. And I got to tell you, like, if I was embroiled in a thing with where my daughter was a pawn in something, I felt like, and that she was being used to destroy my career at the Bulwark or something, I just fucking quit my career at the Bulwark.
Yeah.
Right. Like, I mean, the weirdness of, well, you know, I'm going to sit here and fight this out because I gotta protect my job. Like, no, you have to protect your daughter and your family. And if that means you have to suck up something unfair, then that's what you do because that's what men do, you motherfucker. Like, I just.
Well, he doesn't care about his daughter. Obviously, he probably abused her. That's the allegation.
No, I mean, what I'm trying to say is this man is psychotic.
Yeah, like this doesn't make sense. It doesn't compute to me. It's like, what kind of priorities do you actually have? Why is holding elected office in the House so important? Like, what exactly is he doing?
Leave and fix your family.
Or just fix yourself if you have to. Like, just do anything other than this. And look, I'm not saying this. I'm not going to read this quote because I'm trying to say this is all about – I'm not trying to tie it to Trump. But there was a part of this interview that really jumped out at me where he starts talking about –
I think we have that video
about him talking about how Trump is the template that he wants to follow here. I'd like to play that.
Question is, are all three of these women who don't know each other, are all three of them lying?
Yes, it's very easy, and I can tell you why. Every single time, and people have asked me, you know, what are you going to do? Are you going to drop out of this race? Are you going to resign? You know, are you going to get out before the deadline? And my answer to you, Jake, is no. And I can tell you why. In 2016, when President Donald J. Trump faced the most extreme allegations in the world that hit him day after day after day, and people in the media, very much like yourself and others, said that he would have no shot at winning, that he should not be the president of the United States. But guess what? He stayed in and he was resilient. And what the American people can see is that they can see that somebody is fighting who is resilient, and that is a quality that the American people cherish.
Okay. Here's the thing. Besides the cherish part, he's not wrong.
No, but also that wasn't sort of what I took away from it. My takeaway was how pernicious Trump has been on people just like this who look at that example and say, you know what? Like, it's more manly to stick it out and hold elected office than it is to take care of my shit, right? Like, how also Trump winning and everyone rallying behind Trump in that moment gave every single psychopath or problematic person in politics a permission structure to say, you know what, voters don't really give a shit about this stuff, and I can basically bullshit my way through it. I'm struck by that, and in a way that's like kind of a little jarring for me, because that his North Star is Trump, and his ultimate objective is power, and he has his priorities all out of whack for the reasons that JVL articulated.
If Donald Trump wanted Max Miller out of the race, he could do it. Right? This is, I mean, the hold Donald Trump has over Republican voters is such that if he came out tonight and said, you know what, Max Miller is a bum, he's terrible, I demand that he get out, or we're going to send some people over to his house or something like that, Max Miller would get out of the fucking race. And the fact that Republicans are not going to clean up their mess here is just one more indictment of them as an institution and as a party. I mean, say what you will about the Democrats, right? How long was it from the story with the credible allegations of abuse with Graham Plattner to him getting, like, so being clear he was going to be out of the race? It was like 72 hours, I think. And this guy's just been there. Everybody's known about this for forever. And he's just sitting there, and I think he's going to make it. Am I wrong? Do you guys think there's a chance that he actually gets pressured
out? There continues to be a drip, drip, drip here. And I think that one thing that they do have that some of these other people who have had these allegations, like, were able to blame, like, the liberal media, et cetera. But because the accusers include Donald Trump's spokesperson and the daughter of a Republican senator, you're seeing the stuff come out in Daily Caller, Daily Mail. I do, you know, and so I do think that is what makes him a little bit more vulnerable to this idea that, oh, these are left-wing, paid for by Soros accusers or whatever. This is Kavanaugh part two. It's kind of hard to do that when it's Stephanie Grisham and the senator's daughter. And you can try, and I think that he'll probably get away with it.
Is this dangerous for Moreno that he becomes seen as, like, what is he doing? I'm talking about these women, and, you know, real men ought to be allowed to treat their women.
I don't think so, but I think it's hard. It makes it hard for Trump, like, a little bit. Like, Trump can't throw him over, and he could, I guess. He can do whatever he wants, but, like, that it goes fundamentally against his ethos. Never apologize, never give in on anything, never give these people an inch. You know, it begins to open the door to, what do you do about Corey Mills? What do you do about Chuck Edwards?
I have no hopes that Trump or expectations Trump will do anything other than show empathy for the guy. And as for Moreno, like, I'm not going to weigh in too heavily on that. I have no earthly clue the extent of the pain and weirdness that he's going through. So I don't want to weigh in. The person who I think looks like a total doofus and a charlatan is Mike Johnson, the pious Speaker of the House, a man of great character who can weigh in on anyone else's scandal if they got a D next to their name. This guy, this is in his caucus. This guy's in his caucus, and he's not going to do jack shit about it. I mean, spare me the piety when any other moment. You can't speak out about him or Corey Mills. It's ridiculous.
I want to go back to the original point, though, because I agree with Sam about how Trump laid the ground for this, but I want to add another layer to it about the people that are complicit. The people that said that Trump was disqualified and then came around are the ones actually that laid the ground for this, you know? And I felt that way. I had a lot of negative feelings that I don't like to refresh on the night of 2016 November. But, like, one of those thoughts was just, like, these people don't know what they've wrought. I not only just because whatever Trump does, but because this is now changed how things work forever. Like, things don't exist in a vacuum like this, and like, the unintended consequences of this are manifest. We're seeing it throughout the Republican Party, and all these fucking people, like, those people I have the most contempt for. Like, three that come to mind were on Fox trying to get condescending about Graham Plattner, Kevin McCarthy, we take care of our mess. Ryan's pretty best. Oh, yeah. We do stuff, you know, Kellyanne. Ranting. And it's just like Reince Priebus and Kellyanne and Kevin McCarthy did this to us, did this to the country. Like they all could have tried. I mean, who knows? Trump could have gone on by himself and still won anyway. But like they all had agency and they all said Trump was disqualified and then got back on board and then he won. And then they got big jobs and then they got speakerships and now they're rich and famous. And they tried to like make themselves feel better about their moral failings by like wagging their finger at the Democrats. And the Democrats maybe deserved a finger wag or two over Graham Plattner. But like in the end, they did what was required, as you said, JVL, and these guys won't do it. And
have they said a single word?
Two other House guys that have accusations.
Have any of those three people in the comment section, please, if you can help us search this, I know the answer, but have any of those three said a single damn word about Max Miller? Doubt it.
Can't imagine.
What a horrible human being. Well, you know, maybe someday we'll get to see bad things happen to him because there's no delicacy in life like watching bad things happen to bad people. It's one of my mantras. I think it's pretty healthy. Tim, did you ever hear that in therapy? Did your therapist ever say to you, you know, Tim, if you could just hold out to watch for bad things happening to bad people, that's how you find true peace?
No. No, you know, it's interesting. I spent a lot of my therapy time working on letting go and not letting my resentment at people who were rewarded after doing horrible things consume me. And so a little bit of a different approach.
Different approach.
Which is why you bring it up on the podcast to tonight.
Yeah. Well, I haven't fully succeeded, Sam.
Sure. Sure.
But it's all, you know, we're all growing as humans, you know,
we're going to talk about something very close in this in a moment, featuring one of my idols, one of the people I look to as an avatar of what I could be as a journalist, as a leader, as a founder. We're going to talk about Barry Weiss in a minute. But first, Tim, a message from our sponsor.
Oh, no. Tim? Really?
Tim. This is
Tim?
You?
A message from our sponsor? We should just vamp for a second while Tim gets the sponsor ad.
Tim, get his ad up.
Is it three-day blinds?
Is it our yes. Yes, there we go.
You got it.
We love our friends at three-day blinds, don't we? You know, these are the people that actually pay me. Only people that we're taking any money from over here are the ones that we talk about. And these paid advertisements, this show is sponsored by 3-Day Blinds. I've got a problem at my house right now. The guest room is not dark enough. And I got a great mattress there in the guest room. And so whether it's me sleeping there because I got in trouble with my husband or because I, you know, decided I just wanted to sleep on the good mattress, or whether it's a friend that comes to town, I don't feel like they're getting the morning rest they deserve. And so what I'm doing right now is turning to our friends at 3-Day Blinds, who offer a better way to blind by blind shade shutters and drapery. You can shop for it right at home. You don't got to go to the blind store because obviously I'm not going to do that. They got local professionally trained design consultants who have 10 plus years of experience. They provide expert guidance on the right blinds for you in the comfort of your home. 3-Day Blinds is a leading manufacturer of high-quality custom window treatments in the U.S. And right now, if you use my URL, 3dayblinds.com/thenextlevel, they're running a buy one 50% off deal. Buy one, get 50% off deal. That's a good deal on blinds. With 3-Day Blinds, you choose from thousands of options that fit any budget or style, plus from light filtering and blackout blinds to motorization and smart blinds. 3-Day Blinds is a real upgrade to your home, not just a replacement. Right now, get quality window treatments to fit your budget with 3-Day Blinds. Head to 3dayblinds.com/thenextlevel for their buy one, get one 50% off deal on custom blinds, shades, and drapery for a free, no charge, no obligation consultation. Just head to 3dayblinds.com/thenextlevel one last time. That's buy one, get one 50% off when you head to the number 3daybl.com/thenextlevel. What an ad read. We love 3-Day Blinds.
Such a professional. all right. So as we were prepping for today's show, Tim slacked us a photo that he said he could not chase out of his brain. Tim, here's the photo. Can you tell the people what it is we're looking at? Okay.
It's indescribable, but I'm going to try it. So we're in Sun Valley. Sun Valley is where the elites in tech and media hobnob. Was it Paul Allen that started Sun Valley? I don't get invited to any of this shit, and I wouldn't go if I was invited. That's fine. Just a quick aside. Did you see the controversy around dialogue? Was something Peter Thiel, I guess, started, and then people met in the woods and went to a conference and they saw panels, and then there was like outrage, the list leaked, and there was outrage at the people who went. And I got some texts where, like, I was proud of you to not be on that list. And I was like, you know what? It's the only one of these things I've ever been invited to was that stupid thing. And you can't think of a torture for me worse than sitting in the woods with other people sniffing their own farts, doing panels, talking about the future of tech, blah, blah, blah. Like, it's horrible. So anyway, I'd never be caught dead at one of these things. But there are two interesting things about this photo I want to talk about. One is Barry Weiss is apparently in a doctor's smock. Which JVL, who's a 1/16th of a doctor, could say something about that. But more importantly, Sheryl Sandberg, who she's with, had written the book Lean In, former Facebook executive. If I don't know if you can zoom in there, but she's carrying two books. And if you look closely at the one closest to her breast there, it says Unfettered. And that is John Fetterman's book. And so that makes you wonder, what's the other book? And that's also John Fetterman's book. She's carrying two copies of John Fetterman's memoir. John Fetterman can't talk. Like, John Fetterman came on my podcast and he can't enunciate complex thoughts if he isn't prepared for the question. And so has there ever been a good senator's book? When was the last good senator's book? Kennedy's? There just aren't good senator's books ever. And so the idea that of all the senator's books that you'd want to grab two copies of is Unfettered. I can't understand. I need answers. I need someone who knows Sheryl Sandberg. I might know one listener who might know Sheryl Sandberg. So I'm calling on you to contact her and ask her why she was carrying two copies of his book. Was it a favor? Is she planning on reading them? Was she reading one for herself, giving one to a niece or a friend?
Sam? What are your thoughts about this?
The first instinct was maybe Fetterman's in Aspen and he's handing out copies of signed books, but that's not the case at all.
Sun City. They're in Sun City, not Aspen.
Are they in Sun City? Maybe he's in Sun City. I don't know. Let's see. Sun City.
Ansley, effort that for us.
Oh, yeah. Let's look into that.
Sun Valley. Like I said, I don't get invited to this shit.
Yeah, okay. You know? It's an odd choice for literature. I agree with you 100%. These books are bad as bad.
Oh, yeah, he was there. Him and David McCormick. They're doing their buddy tour together.
Okay, so this explains why. So he's there. He's doing his buddy tour with McCormick.
It does?
It explains why she has two of the books. Why would you need two?
If you attended a panel with Dave McCormick and John Fetterman, would you walk out with two copies of Unfettered, the John Fetterman story?
Moderated by Aaron Burnett.
Thank you,
Emily. I'm more intrigued by Barry Weiss's outfit than this, because I think she just got two signed copies of the Fetterman book and she's, I don't know, is carrying them around. Barry's outfit is just unreal. Like the doctor lab coat in the beach bag with the reflecting glasses is really a look. And I'm not sure if this is part of the panel experience or not. Maybe she was on some health panel. But the Fetterman book, it's a boring book, but I'm just assuming he signed it for her and she's now carrying it around.
I will just say that if you ever needed proof that all of these people are intellectual frauds, this is it right here in this photo. Like, Barry Weiss is somehow the premier public intellectual of her day. And she's an idiot. She's not actually very smart. She's very poorly read. She's fucking terrible at her job. She's driving CBS News into the ground. And Sheryl Sandberg, like, here they're like, oh, I'm here for the working man. It's what to really broaden up things. And, oh, but I only want to hang out with all of these people who were early at Facebook. Fucking, oh my God in heaven.
Do you see the other CBS story today? Speaking of Barry, Sharon Alfonso was working on a story about Epstein and banking, and they had interviewed Ron Wyden, and apparently they had some information from, we don't know exactly the details, from his bank accounts, and that story has been killed. I don't know what's happening behind the scenes at CBS. Maybe they're planning a big Epstein takedown.
Well, they have Ross on that.
Series. Yeah, they got Ross.
Ross Douthat is now heading. They pass that off to him.
I am suspect, but we can wait and see for the fall tour. And it's just, again, it's so telling. Like, the whole conceit of like That's funny. Like, remember, the origin of the free press is like, the elites won't tell you that there's groupthink at the New York Times, and like, we're not, you know, we're going to be the ones that speak the truth and are unafraid. And it's like, yeah, well, we're going to kill the Epstein story, and I'm going to hang out in Sun City with Sheryl
Sun
Sandberg.
Valley.
Sun Valley with Sheryl Sandberg, and we're going to read Unfettered by John Fetterman. It's just
like, it is true that all these people who complain about the establishment are just now the establishment, and they're never going to get over that.
But they were $228. She was at the New York Times complaining about the establishment.
Yes, that's true too.
She went to an Ivy League school.
Yeah. E. Zeddy says those are $228 sweatpants. That's nice.
Okay. Moving on. Tim, while you were away, we had big movement in the Judge Jeanine reflecting pool case. You talked about that a little bit with Bill on Monday. Yesterday, the president said, well, in the Oval Office, that Judge Jeanine folded like an umbrella. Do we have that clip, boys?
Really disappointed with Jeanine Pirro. She folded like an umbrella, and people get away with things. It's a disgrace.
It's a disgrace.
She choked.
Interesting.
Like a dog.
Chief umbrellas are kind of hard to fold. Just a minor nitpick there. No? Like a cheap umbrella. Sometimes you get a cheap umbrella from the guy on the street, and you're like trying to close it up, and it gets caught. It's not a great metaphor.
I don't know. I always go to Consumer Reports and buy the best reviewed umbrella. I don't do cheap umbrellas, Timothy. We haven't had a chance to talk about this. I wrote a little bit about this. There is a funny thing going on here, which is that Judge Jeanine plays by the rules of television most of the time, which is what Donald Trump plays by, which is what Doug Burgum plays by, except that every once in a while she has to play by the rule of law when she like submits something that's a sworn document to the court, where if she's being untruthful, they can disbar her or put her in jail. And this is a real structural disadvantage she has relative to Doug Burgum, because Doug Burgum just said whatever the fuck he wants. Like, Doug Burgum would be like, man, what are you talking about, man? Yeah, we didn't say it was failure stuff. It was all vigilante shit. Talk with Tay-Tay about that, you know? And I find it delicious and wonderful that Judge Jeanine was forced one time to be truthful because she was under the penalty of perjury. And that now may cost her everything. Do you have thoughts about this?
I like the idea. No bad ideas in a brainstorm. I like thinking outside the box. I think it's, you know, my issues with it are a couple. One is that people like lie under oath on the Hill all the time. And it doesn't really seem like we're enforcing that. So this administration's lied a lot during hearings on the Hill. So there's that. People trying to get cabinet secretary positions have lied during those hearings. The Judge Jeanine thing, what I really can't figure is why not do Trump? Why not do Judge Jeanine? Why not do Judge Box of Wine? Take your crap case, bring it to the judge, you know, give him some grainy video. And then when you fail, just be like, the liberal judge appointed by Joe Biden. It's the, you know, we need, this is why we need to pack the DC circuit. I think would have been a better approach, but she for some reason decided that she was like, I'm going to take a stand on the reflecting pool case.
I think she thought she could shift it to Burgum. I think she thought, if I do that, I have to eat the shit sandwich. But if I do it this way in the motion, and I bring all of my evidence about the shit that the Interior Department told me, I can lay this at Burgum's feet, and then he'll be the one in trouble with the boss.
Right. So I talked to Andrew Weissman about this for On Legal News. I don't think it's coming out tomorrow, I think. To your point, Tim, I think you're right. Like, she could have done it. I think the issue here was, and this is Andrew speculating, was that there were probably some actual lawyers in that office who were worried about getting disbarred or some sort of professional consequence.
Yeah.
Because of how thin and obviously transparently political the case was and how ridiculous it was. At some point, you face the music, right? You could get the case dismissed and you look embarrassed there, but you do risk professional repercussions and certain reputational damage. I will make a slight disagreement with JVL about Burgum, though. And Andrew kind of plopped the idea in my head. So hear me out. this filing that the motion to dismiss that Pirro puts out basically says, I was misled by the Department of Interior. Like, they just lied to us. They didn't tell us the full extent of the damage to the installation. All right. So she, the Justice Department, is laying responsibility. The premier law enforcement agency and company is laying responsibility for misleading the court at the feet of Doug Burgum. This guy, David Hearn, the Olympian who was charged, everyone's like, well, he should sue. He should sue for reputational damages. He should get his legal fees back. The question is, who do you sue? He has a case potentially against Burgum. He does. Because Burgum, according to Pirro, misled the Justice Department into bringing charges against him, David Hearn. Hearn could turn around and say, you know what? I'm not going to sue Pirro for putting this case together. I'm going to sue Burgum for slandering me and putting a fake case. I don't know if he'll do it, but it's
This is why I thought the money quote in the motion to dismiss was the part where Judge Jeanine lays out the actual case and statute that the Department of Interior was violating. She's like, you know, we had an affirmative obligation pursuant to Brady v. Maryland of the Jenks Act. And, you know, Rule 16 tells us we had to do this thing, but we couldn't because of what the Department of the Interior did. She's like, you could sue them with this.
Now, Andrew said, under a normal, you know, universe, which never would happen, the Justice Department could, in theory, sue Burgum. The Justice Department.
Yeah.
Because they got misled by him. They're not going to do that, obviously. But I don't think there's anything stopping, you know, who's Norm Eisen representing David Hearn? I don't know. From them being like, hey, Judge Jeanine has said the statute that you violated. My client was harmed by that. Pay up.
We have a sworn statement in the motion to dismiss. So I'm trying to be more of a solutions guy.
Yeah.
Instead of just a complaint guy. And so I wrote about this on, I think it was Monday. I proposed a law. Something maybe for the Democratic caucus to think about come 2029, for the transparency requirements under Modern Presidents Act, in which, because, you know, post-Watergate, there were a bunch of post-Watergate reforms to try to fix the system. I think we're going to have to do that, too, here. And so in the post-Trump reforms, the Trump Act would take high-ranking executive branch appointees, maybe even the president themselves, and when they are speaking under the aegis of their department, agency, or whatnot, they have to be sworn in. And to your question, we would have to set up a court to monitor this. So there would, you know, you can, when people perjure themselves, it's only a problem if there is a body there to bring those perjury charges. I feel like we could, you know, if we maybe have part of the statute and impanels an inspector general to bring suits for perjury against people violating the Trump Act in, say, the D.C. District Court. I just feel like this is a thing we could think our way around, and we should make people like Judge Jeanine treat public statements when they're behind a podium like that as if they are under oath, as if it's a sworn deposition.
I got ahead of myself because I had already read your triad. And so my pushback to this was what was previously offered about how they're lying. They do lie under oath in already. And so it's not foolproof. Nothing's foolproof. I like the idea. You know, I would like to turn to Andrew Weissman. There could be some free speech concerns here. I don't know exactly the potential.
Small free speech concerns. Maybe
the Supreme Court. I don't know.
There could be free speech.
Maybe an avenue potentially for over litigation and a lot of lawsuits flying back and forth.
We'd probably have to expand the Supreme Court first before getting to the Trump Act, because I don't know. I don't see the current Supreme Court upholding it. So there might be an order of operations issue as well.
Yeah, you have to expand the Supreme Court before you can do anything, because there is nothing that a Democratic president can do in 2029 that this court wouldn't strike down.
There are a couple of things.
Yeah. Anyway, just you know, trying to think outside the box. This is why people subscribe to the triad. You know, they want to have.
I'm surprised you haven't used solutions. The triad to push for Tri-California, which I think is
it's funny. You say that.
Is that coming
because
tomorrow you're doing Tri-California?
We have. More states. That is the title.
Are you including Tri-California in the more states?
That's right.
How many more?
I mean, we should start with five.
Okay, well, I had four. I had a net five because it'd be four with adding DC and Puerto Rico, creating Trilifornia, and then merging Utah and Idaho into Utaho. So that would take away two.
It's coming. Just people, you know, so stay tuned tomorrow. It's going to be great.
Honestly, we're gonna talk a little bit more about Gavin Newsom has the courage and wants to be the 2028 nominee. His lap, like he's
we
got.
We can do Trilifornia if only Gavin Newsom has the courage.
He's got 4 months to get moving on Trilifornia.
All right, we're going to talk about Todd Blanche, and then we're going to go back to Michigan and break down the results there because we'll know a lot more. But first, a word from our final sponsor. Sam, take it away.
All right. This segment is sponsored by, drumroll please, the New York Times. So we obviously are having this great conversation tonight as pundits, but we need to tip our cap to the shoe leather journalists who are breaking the stories that we are chewing over. One such story is, as we just mentioned, about Judge Jeanine Pirro and her falling stock inside the Trump administration. So after the president said she folded like an umbrella, which Tim rightfully points out, maybe is not the best metaphor, by dropping charges against the alleged vandals of the reflecting pool. That story we got courtesy of Tyler Pager, Glenn Thrush, and Katie Rogers, who had an account of the meeting between Trump, Pirro, and Interior Secretary Doug Burgum inside the Oval Office. Now, there's a lot of background in that story on how Trump was angry at Pirro, about how Doug Burgum was trying to save face before Trump, and why Trump may not yet be moving to fire Pirro, and how Pirro herself doesn't think she's going to get fired. Anyway, these reporters spent a long time developing whatever sources they had for this story, and it's become clear that in the second Trump White House, it is a large and harder endeavor to get scoops and good sources from inside the administration. Now, as a newsroom editor, I got to say, I do respect, really respect how the Times has been able to maintain those contacts. I know there are a lot of people in our audience and maybe even on this podcast who can be tough on the mainstream reporting and even occasionally on the New York Times.
Really?
Not JVL. No. You've never said it.
And sometimes deserved.
Sometimes.
A lot of addition by subtraction going on, honestly.
All right, but in the end, and I do mean this sincerely, the truth...
there's the end of that sponsorship.
Yeah, exactly. I'm going to save it. In the end, the truth is that the New York Times mission really, really, really does matter. I mean that sincerely. They are the gold standard of news. The Foundation News Commentary is fact-based reporting, and this show and every other show with commentary on current events does depend on original fact-based reporting, like what they do at the New York Times and what many of our reporters do here at the Bulwark as well. Shout out to them. So now you all get to decide what you think about Jeanine Pirro's future, and you do so with a bit of knowledge courtesy of the Times. Without fact-based reporting like this, the rest of us are just guessing. So wherever you seek it out, nationally, locally,
Jonathan Cohn,
fact-based reporting. I have to read that again because that's the one line that they demand I read perfectly and you interrupted it. So wherever you seek it out, nationally, locally, support fact-based reporting.
And Jonathan Cohn. While you're doing that, I was looking at some of these other races that are happening. Just a few interesting things I want to flag. Maybe we can talk for a second about the Kansas Senate race, I think, is a little bit of a sleeper. And it looks Roger Marshall is a totally worthless cuck. He won by 11 points the last time. I think Trump's definitely more than 11% down from 2020 approval-wise. And the Democrats look like, I think we have a call, actually. The Democrats are doing something I think it's smart. At least it's unconventional. It's something people aren't talking about as much with all the DSA hysteria. But they're nominating a guy named Adam Hamilton, who is a pastor of a megachurch, actually. He thought about running as an independent, decided to run as a Democrat. He's very, very moderate, kind of doing a little bit of a Rob Sand type approach in Kansas. I'm intrigued by that. I also was just kind of cruising through the Virginia results. Nothing really that interesting except I think it's kind of crazy, and this kind of also relates to the DSA discourse a little bit. It's kind of crazy that nobody primaried Mark Warner. Like, Mark Warner has been in there forever, and, relatively good senator, but relatively accommodating at times. And just, again, it kind of shows the distinction between the Tea Party stuff, where people were dropping like flies everywhere. And I kind of thought that was interesting, especially compared to what you saw from some of these other senators, Michael Bennett, et cetera.
Can't you say there's a weird thing happening in Kansas, which we were kind of looking into, but it didn't get much attention. But they changed the laws of the state where if like Roger Marshall were to drop out at a certain point, they would just have a placeholder for the next 2 years, not a real, not election this year. So there's like some weird speculation going on in Kansas that Marshall may just decide to hold on for until that deadline and then drop out. Something to keep your eye on. Okay.
In Missouri, the first district in Missouri, we had sort of an interesting race there with Wesley Bell, and he was challenged by Cori Bush, who he unseated in 2024. She came back for more. She gone with 41%, and he's up by nearly 40 points. He's up by 38 points.
Wow.
Interesting. Is that interesting or no? Is that just totally expected?
I think it's interesting just because it's kind of counter narrative. You know, these things are a little more complicated. Right. One other thing I just want to mention that happened today, and then we can do Blanche, but South Dakota, again, this is like, now we're in real stretch territory, but I just, you have to put as many chances on the board as possible in a wave year. You know, maybe, you know, surprising state hits. I've seen that in the past many times. And South Dakota had kind of an independent guy named Brian Bangs, interesting candidate, but they had a Democrat still on the ballot, Julian Bodian, I think is how you pronounce the name. And today was the deadline for them to coalesce, and Julian Bodian decided to drop out, which, shout out to them, patriotic decision. I mean, that would have been a hopeless race as a three-way, and it's still obviously a big long shot, but something to monitor, Brian Bangs, if you're in South Dakota.
We're going to go back to Michigan. I think we're going to wait and close that out with Michigan, okay. And we will talk just very quickly about Todd Blanche. He's in. He's through.
Well,
Tom Tillis, and
he's not through yet. He's through the committee. He's got the
Senate. Well, he's through still. The committee, but right. You know, Susan Collins knows that she can vote against him since he's going to be confirmed. So she can show her independence so long as it doesn't matter. And Tom Tillis and John was it Cornyn? No, who was?
It was Cornyn. Yeah,
Cornyn. Yeah. They just settled back down into the cuck chair and held out their little piece of paper that they got signed. And I just don't understand. I tried talking this through with Sarah on Friday, and I have to circle back and do it again with you guys because I was unpersuaded by her. I don't understand. I would understand Cornyn and Tillis saying, I'm too old for this shit. I don't care. Whatever. You want Todd Blanche? Have Todd Blanche. I would understand that. Wouldn't like it, but I'd understand it. I would understand them saying, this guy sucks and fuck you, Donald Trump. We don't care who you nominate. I'm not voting for him. I understand that too. And I'd like that. I don't understand them setting up a totally surmountable obstacle, making Trump mad at them, alibying Trump, and then folding so that Trump can get his way. That seems like a sour spot, which does, like, what, just as a human psychology piece, why would they choose to do that?
I think I can answer.
Okay.
I think it's good old boy club situation. I think that they've gotten to know Todd Blanche. This is obviously preposterous to me. So, you know, putting myself in the head of John Cornyn, like, you know, I'd rather rip my toenails off. But I think he sees Todd Blanche as somebody they can do business with, you know, somebody they can rub elbows with, probably likes him at some level, and feels like you deal with him. And these guys have spent 10 years rationalizing that, like, Trump can be managed, and that, like, oh, the criticisms are overwrought, and the, you know, the libs have Durant, the libs are the real danger. And remember Merrick Garland? Remember how Merrick Garland weaponized the Justice Department against Donald Trump? This isn't any worse than that. And so I just think they have all those rationalizations in their head, and they, good old boys club, maybe they want to lobby again at the end of this thing. They want to keep their financial money open.
Do they think they won? Like, do they walk out of this thinking?
No. John Cornyn said yesterday, did you see that video? He looked so frustrated when he was like, it's not like we can control Trump.
He said that this morning. The quote is, there's nothing we can do to rein in the president.
I'm sure there is. Don't vote for his nominee.
Let me test run another theory for you behind you guys, by you guys, and you can tell me if I'm wrong. I never worked on the Senate. I don't know. Tim, do you ever work on the Senate or no? Okay.
Not a Hill guy.
Okay. So what if this is not about Trump or Cornyn or Tillis? What if this is about John Thune? Okay. Let me hear me out. Those guys like Thune. They know Thune is rational and they want him to stay in his position. And they know that Thune can only really stay in his position if he can show that he can move some of Trump's agenda. Trump's flipping out over the SAVE Act. It's not going to pass. They need to get in line at some point and get Thune to show that he can succeed as majority leader. Because if he can't on this stuff, Trump will absolutely take him out. And that's what this is about.
I think that that relates to my theory too. And I just, because it's good old boy theory. It's like,
it is.
Want to still be in the club. So maybe it's less about Blanche and it is about Thune. And these guys don't have any, I mean, here's what it really comes down to. Sarah's not on the pod this week, so I can just do it. It's my one pass. They're pussies.
You can say that word now, though, because
it's hard. It's hard. Look, forget even the politics of it. It's hard. Like, think about anything in your life, like where there's a group of people.
Spite isn't hard. Spite is like,
sorry, JBL. It's hard. There's a group of people that want something and they're your friends and you have to be the one that's like, nope, we shouldn't do this, guys. You can do it. People out there have gumption. People are antisocial like you, JBL, or they have courage and backbone like Sarah. But for most people, it's hard. And most people are the P word. And these guys especially.
All right. Well, there it is. All right. So we're going to go back to Missouri. We can bring up the video there. Michigan. It's a long night. We're way past my bedtime. And we now have 28% of the vote in, and things have tightened up a little bit. This is John Cone does not have the best audio right now, but he has been feeding us some intelligence. And he says that Haley has gotten slightly better results in some counties. And we have a tweet here from Jordan Schwartz, who says the race will come down to Wayne County Election Day vote. Stevens is doing extremely well in rural Michigan relative to expectations, and a good Wayne result could allow her to win this primary.
Wow. Boy, we're going to have to delete the first 20 minutes of the podcast if that
They never happened. Don't worry.
That's it. I mean, a big underperformance by Al Sayed. And I guess I would have to say if that's what happens, and maybe then we should just pause on this and finish our takes at the end once we learn more. But it would be worrying. Like, at some level, if he's going to win, I would kind of would have liked him to really run away with it.
Because, run away, right?
Yeah, because, yeah, you know, there's some signal that he could underperform. Again, I think that the thing about Michigan and the Senate, governor's races are different. I think that the Hong situation in Wisconsin is a whole nother bag of potatoes. But Senate races these days, like, there's almost never cross-party vote. Like, the only Senate races that went opposite each other recently were Collins and Gideon in Maine. Collins, I think, had a unique brand in Maine. You got to give it to her. Slotkin and Trump in Michigan. But that was, like, luck. God love Alyssa Slotkin, but, like, she got basically the same amount of votes as Kamala did, and there were a bunch of Trump voters that went in there and were just like, I don't care about the Senate race. Like, that's why she won. And then in Gallego, you got to give credit to. He did much better with Hispanics, and so is Gallego and Trump. Like, that's basically it. So you don't see a ton of Senate races where the state goes counter to the party. And I think, you know, what we're going to get with Trump at the Bush line, El Sayed would have to, like, not just underperform, but, like, massively, massively Roy Moore-style underperform to lose. But it would still be a little bit alarming if he underperformed the primary.
Well, so here's a question, though. I mean, there's underperforming, and then there's something else, right? So what Jonathan was saying was that it looked like the turnout level was overall very, very high.
Yeah.
And, I mean, underperforming with a low turnout erection...
Whoa!
Sorry, Sarah.
With a low night.
Turnout election,
bulwark after dark,
is one thing, but if you wind up with a lot of voters coming out, and, you know, you're winning a close race, or, it says something different, right? I mean, it says there are people that you're activating, and you are bringing out people, but also you're polarizing people too, right? I mean, is that a fair read of this,
Trump, Sam? Yeah.
Well, I was just curious, and I was asking the Slack channel if independents and Republicans can vote in this primary. And Connor says that there's no party registration. Anyone can vote in either primary. I don't have anything other than that to speculate on, but it wouldn't necessarily shock me if there were some people who rushed into the Democratic primary to, you know, maybe cast vote in favor of Stevens because they're worried about LSA, right? Like, that wouldn't be shocking to me. I think turnout is, look, who knows what we're going to be like in a month, but I think one of the key takeaways from every one of these elections, not just this, but the special elections and every polling data that you see, is enthusiasm to vote. And by and large, Democratic voters are really enthusiastic and Republicans aren't. And so, to Tim's point, it's going to help across the ticket.
I guess I'll just say one other thing. The reason what I meant by underperform, actually, because I'll say in some ways this way overperformed, but his expectations would have been going into this primary. What I meant is underperform the polling. And, you know, and I just think that would be something to keep your eye on, because for a while there was, what was it called? The Wilder rule or whatever, Doug Wilder in Virginia, where, you know, that he was black, was the first one to win, but the polls showed him way ahead. He ended up barely winning. And for a while, black candidates underperformed their polls. Not really, that isn't really the
case
anymore.
It's called the Bradley,
effect, not Wilder. Fuck, you're right. But yeah. Bradley is also in Virginia. Thank you, Sam. God, this is when you're starting to get old. You start to lose facts like that. They start to leak out the ears. I'm disappointed in myself. Chastise me, chat. Trump then had this. He was being underperformed in the polls for kind of a different reason. And so, I don't know. It just be something to monitor, whether there are people that don't feel comfortable saying that they're going to vote, you know, particularly in a Democratic primary, don't want to be like, I'm against him, he's Muslim. They don't want to feel like they're being bigoted or whatever. That's about as half-baked a theory as Sam's people crossing over. But at this point, you know, he's polling 12 to 16 plus, and he's up 6. So we'll see what Wayne County looks like. So these other votes.
So, that means it's going to be pretty late. I mean, it really does come down to Detroit. The question is how much Haley can win by in Detroit. That's going to be a late night. So here, let's have our DSA colloquy. You promised a DSA rant, Tim. I proposed another solution today in the triad because it's solutions week in the triad today. But I feel like people know they're really two DSAs, and we ought to like split the Mensheviks from the Bolsheviks. And I feel like we should do that, and we can do that pretty easily. We should have social Democrats, which is, I would say, probably like the majority of Bernie voters are not Democratic Socialists. They're social Democrats in the European tradition. But I want to hear what you have to say.
I liked that article and that newsletter a lot. And I think that there's a fact that I saw this week that bolstered it, which was, I think it was our friends at The Argument did a poll about free trade. And they asked, you know, essentially, like, are you pro or anti free trade? And the category that was the most pro free trade was people who said that they were DSA sympathetic, which is like, you know, in the traditional sense, the DSA types were like the protectionist, anti free trade parts of the party, and the neoliberals and the centrists were the more free trade. And I think that what that says is that there is definitely I wouldn't even say small. Like a somewhere between small and medium, a small plus, a medium light core of people that are really DSA, and their motivating issues are Medicare for all, Israel, anti-corporate involvement in politics. It's, and they really
workers.
Hate workers, and they workers. Really hate the center left, and that is a real existing demographic.
The Uniparty.
They hate the Uniparty, right? And then I think that there's a bunch of other people. And I have some of them in my life, so I know they exist, who are like basically conventional Democrats, but they're like, fuck these guys. Trump has won twice. What have you done for me lately? Like, I'm going to take a flyer on these other guys. Maybe we need more. I'm kind of done with incremental change. We'll do some more radical change. And then if you read that group, the DSA platform on the DSA website, they'd be like, I don't know about that radical. You know, I was thinking more like we're going to tax the billionaires and we're going to do Supreme Court expansion and whatever. You know, we're going to do kind of Medicare for all who want it, right? Like
ban on data centers.
Right. Ban on data centers. Right. And we want some more aggressive stuff. And they're saying their DSA, they're reflecting that. You know, kind of that's a way to kind of register just like with the Democratic Party. And both those, and so I agreed. I thought your analysis was right. And I think there is basically, I think there's actually probably three groups. There's like a social Democrats that want the party to be like Sweden. There's a kind of a DSA core. And then there's a group that's like, the DSA right now is the stand-in for my anger at the establishment. And if someone else gave me another option, maybe I'd look at that. So I think that's happening. My main thing that I just wanted to rant about, sorry, Sam, just, you know, get comfy. You start looking at the poll numbers while I do a rant, is I tried to bubble myself on vacation as much as possible. And I thought it was noteworthy that the thing that kept breaking through my bubble via texts or whatever, I was on only Instagram, was like, just, there's a lot of DSA discourse. There's a lot of consternation about it. It's being driven a lot by the Republicans, but there are a lot of moderate factionalists that love talking about this. And it's like the thing that they talk about the most, concerns about the DSA. And I just, I would like to, I want to help the Democrats help themselves a little bit on this. And Abdul Saeed, we should just say, does not say that he's a socialist. He does not say that he's DSA. But he kind of,
I just want to throw this in there for people. So John Cohn, who was listening to us, slacked us and said very emphatically, Abdul Saeed is definitely a social Democrat and not like a Democratic socialist within the artificial divide I've created.
Republicans are going to try to turn him into a socialist, right? And they're going to use this as a boogeyman. And there's a lot of discourse about, is this, should the Democrats be scared of this? Is this going to be a big problem? And I just like, I find it very galling that all this is happening while Donald Trump is running the country as a MAGA socialist. And I do think that it's like incumbent upon Democrats and Democratic commentators, particularly those of us in the middle, to like redirect this question and be like, particularly if this critique is coming from the Republicans, like, you can stand down on talking about socialism unless you can show me that you've spoken out about Donald Trump's socialism. And when I talk about socialism, I don't just mean, like, there are two types. There's the government control of the economy. Donald Trump does completely. JVL, you wrote about this. Yeah.
National socialism.
Yeah, the gas stations, national socialism, the manipulating the markets with his pronouncements, levying tariffs and bullying companies.
Taking stakes in companies.
Hey, we took a stake in Intel.
Yeah. I mean, forcing businesses to come kiss the ring of the king if they want to get certain stuff. I mean, literally illegally taxing businesses. And then when the Supreme Court says that the tax was illegal, threatening the business if they ask for a rebate, if they ask for their money back. Like, if Barack Obama had done that, it would be wall-to-wall socialism red scare on Fox for the rest of the term. So Donald Trump is running as a national socialist on the economic side, but doing it kind of with favors for his corporate buddies. This is the oligarchy side of the argument. But on top of that, like, when people do the Red Scare part of socialism, because the Menshevik and Bolshevik comparison also goes to like historical concerns about socialism, right? Like, I was watching some conservative thing the other day where the guy was like, people should read Hayek. Hayek talks about how state control of government always leads to fascism. And that's the real concern about socialism, right? It's like not even just the economy. It's like what we saw from behind the Berlin Wall. And on that score, these guys are the fucking socialists. And they're the ones that have masked men in the streets going after protesters. Like, they're the ones that have masked men shooting protesters with no accountability. They're the ones that created a gulag in El Salvador and sent people there without any due process rights. And there's no concern that any of the DSA candidates, however crazy they are, Hong or even pick the craziest ones, Chevalier, none of them are planning on sending MAGA Americans to foreign gulags. So I just, like, sometimes I feel like that folks are really taking the bait on this. And I think that they're definitely legit, whatever, policy discussions about, I have concerns about the debt, and like, can we afford doing all these programs? Like, there are a lot of legit conversations to have, but like, letting the Republicans like turn this election into socialism and then not, I don't know. It reminds me a little bit of the trans ad. Where, like, the Democrats don't feel like they are prepared to respond to this with the aggression that I think that they should. So that's my rant.
Good rant.
Thank you. Whatever. Sam, what do you got for us before we get to bed? Because you're playing hurt here. You got to be up at 3:45.
I know. You're on way too early.
Hosting tomorrow. Yeah.
Dude, why'd you agree to this? You could have made Edgar do this or something.
It was my fault.
They didn't ask Edgar to host. Sorry, Andrew.
No, you could have made Edgar do this fucking show.
Do this?
No, not way too early.
No, I would never miss this. I don't mind. I love this shit. You know, I'm just trying to ingratiate myself with JVL, so one time I could be called.
Oh my god,
his best friend.
Had a dump in Michigan. Someone has taken a dump. There's been a vote dump, and Haley Stevens is down
behind by 800 votes.
840 votes.
No, come on.
Yeah.
Where do you see that?
The New York Times, baby. Our friends at the New York Times sponsoring this episode, trying to get back in their good graces after that Ross Stoutback joke. There you go.
Great job. Sponsored by the New York Times. Wait, what's that? Hold on one second. Hold that thought. Because without fact-based reporting like this, the rest of us are just guessing. So wherever you seek it out, nationally, locally, support fact-based reporting. This is crazy. I might just stay up and not sleep. You guys want to go to 3:45 a.m. with me?
Watch this. I'm around.
Pass. Hard pass. Okay, let's just hold on for a second here. Because we did the takes of El Said winning. I think we kind of owe it to do a takes of Stevens winning.
Or even even a close loss, honestly.
Okay, let's do that. Let's do on your feet takes. I'm not going first because I haven't developed mine emotionally or philosophically. What's your take, JVL?
If Stevens wins,
pulls it out. Yeah.
If she were to pull out a high turnout election, that would tell me that the DSA stuff really freaked out the Democratic electorate. Right. And again, I mean, just because he is not, a tanky. But, you know, like, he played footsie with the tankies. He began taking off when he appeared with Hassan Piker, and that was sort of the beginning of his rocket shot here. If he was ahead in the polling, if he was really ahead in the polling by as much as we were seeing over the last 3 weeks, and he were to wind up losing this, or it were to be very, very close, that would worry me a little bit. Going into the general, because it would suggest to me that there was a real reticence bubbling around in the electorate.
But what's your Stevens take?
God, people are really motivated by the "she's growing on me" tweet. I'm just joking. Just a little joke, guys. No,
the one you were paid to.
I was like, fucking sitting at the Charlotte airport, just firing off hot takes.
The other thing was two people, who
and then people like, making fun of me. Then the example is then like five other people making fun of me, and I was like, I just liked your little accent, and she was just like, we gotta stick it to them. I think people like the accent. No, there's only one answer to this. If she wins, and it's black voters. The base of the Democratic Party is still black voters, and James Carville, for whatever people's opinions are of him, very polarized these days. One of the things he's absolutely right about is like every Democratic nomination goes through the black church at the presidential level, and he's like, if you can't win the black church, you're not going to be the nominee, and maybe that won't be true at some point in the future. Just out of age demographics and things change, younger black voters aren't as churched as their parents and grandparents, maybe, but for now that's not over yet. And if she's look at this Wayne County number, she's up 63-33 now
in Wayne County. How much is in Wayne?
Wow.
23%.
That's amazing.
So the bad take at the top, shout out bad takes, it was like Wayne County was 2% and it was really close. And I was like, that's not a good sign for her. So it was probably, it's just like, you know, there's really, the urban core, and then there's kind of the more wider parts of the district. And I assume what has happened here is that the urban core has come in. And, you know, and so, yeah, so even if she still loses, but it gets really close, black voters went for Biden. Nobody showed up, back to what I said at the top with Cohn, nobody showed up to his events either. And if you can put together a coalition of the kind of high income, maybe even Mitt Romney voting former Republican types, or even, you know, Jewish voters, and you run up the score with black voters, like, that gets you close to the way there.
And here's my take.
And this one other thing I just want to say, because I do want to shout out the Stevens people. Stevens was running a really bad campaign at the beginning, and the campaign, I think, seemed really bad when she was online. And I think that I started talking to people in Michigan. And like the ad campaign that she was running, I mean, again, some of the stuff is the Apex stuff, so it cuts both ways. But like, I do think that after Mallory dropped out, there was, you know, some improvement in the campaign. So anyway, I don't, you know, who the hell knows how this thing shakes out.
A couple takes that are not intertwined, but something to stew on. One, Democratic voters are rational, pragmatic. Yes, they've elected a couple flaming DSA types, but those have been predominantly in New York City, and elsewhere they have acted rationally. Okay, that's one. Two, online culture remains not totally real. Like, the discourse is just not necessarily what people feel on the ground, and retail politics can work, to your point, Tim, especially in these churches and predominantly urban areas where she was just working. And Cohn wrote about this, and he's in our Slack channel saying he was there. He said, was with her in Detroit over the weekend, lots of people coming up to give her hugs. People acted like she was this terrible candidate. No support wasn't true except in the online world. Three, if she were to sneak this out, everything we said about AIPAC, I don't think is no longer true. I think actually AIPAC still did hurt her. However, it will be used by the El Sayed fan base in really aggressive ways. Like,
she probably for good reason, by the way. I probably won't begrudge it to him because, again, I don't only want because spending.
What was huge the spending, like, disparity? 37 million, something insane.
She outspent him 9-1, I think.
Massive spending disparity. On the Republican side, populist candidates, that happened. Jeb really outspent Donald Trump, and you know how that went. So that money doesn't do everything, but it helps. And I do think that it will lead to more anger, and kind of for good reason on the, not even kind of, for good reason on the populist left, that they're like, how is this really a democracy if there's that kind of much of a spending gap and the money is not coming from Michigan voters, but it's coming from outside interests, no matter what that interest is. So I think that, yes, we'll have to eat a little bit of a crow on AIPAC strategy if she wins, but I do think the backlash will continue to grow.
I mean, this is a real question. I mean, like, maybe money isn't always dispositive, and it could very well be that the AIPAC money wasn't dispositive here, and that AIPAC still did more harm than good to her campaign.
I agree with that. But yeah, it doesn't mean that the LSI people won't use it, right?
Yeah. Sure. Yeah. And I understand why they would, but I'm saying just as a pure political science matter.
Yeah.
I understood what Sam was saying about rational, but I do just want to kind of expand on it a little bit, because I think that actually New York voters were making a rational decision for their interest in voting for leftists. I think that what you were trying to say, which I think is borne out, is that Democratic voters are very strategic, particularly in these swing states. Mm-hmm. And you saw this in the 2020 primary, where it was like Warren was doing very well, and then a New York Times poll comes out that shows Trump beating Warren and Biden beating Trump. And it was like Warren's poll numbers went down 30 points the next day. You know, and so Democratic voters, I do think, particularly in swing states, are very high engagement. Read the news, watch our live streams, read the New York Times. And like, they are that, you know, they vote strategically. I one of the man on the street things I saw today was a guy who basically said he was making a strategic choice for Stevens. So I think that combined with Black voters, and you know, again, I think particularly the older Black voters have not shown a ton of interest in kind of the DSA stuff. Younger Black voters, different.
All right, I'm going to send us out with a quick thought before we leave. The latest dump of numbers gives Abdul al-Sayed a 16,000 vote lead over Haley Stevens. Mallory McMorrow, who is not in this race, has 18,621 votes.
Wow.
Just something for people to keep in mind when they do their voting.
Here's another thing just to throw out really quick before they leave. Saeed's winning big in Kent County, which is Grand Rapids. Decent chunk of votes left there, 60,000 or so. And he's doing okay in Macomb. He's winning in Macomb slightly, and a decent chunk there, 92,000. So we're doing quick math. I'm doing Kornacki here, 150. Wayne. Wayne has 239,000 remaining votes.
Yeah.
So, you know, it depends on like the breakdown of that. You know, does that look more like the first 2%, or does that look more like the last 20%? I mean, if that looks like the last 20%, that augurs well for her. So it just kind of depends on.
But also large Arab populations also in Wayne County.
So yeah, there's a lot, right, lot going on. Yeah. All right, boys, this was lovely. It was grand. Sam, you are a good friend of mine. And I cherish you. In that way.
Tim, Sam, I love you, buddy. Good to see you too.
Yeah. Yeah. Everybody else, hit like, hit subscribe, follow the channel. Here we are staying up way too late. Sam is going to be up way too early. And we do this for you, the people. Hit like, hit subscribe, follow the channel, go to thebulwark.com, subscribe to my newsletter because it's fucking awesome.
I got a good Bulwark Daily coming for you tomorrow, too. It's going to be a banger.
Good luck, America.